Dr. Gerald Bell, leadership guru, co-author of The Carolina Way with Dean Smith. We talk about the book. We talk about leadership in general. We do some self-help work. It's really a good interview, worthy of our 400th episode. We'll get to that. Come back. A lot to do on the back half as well here on The Carolina Insider.
The Carolina Way is something people talk about a lot. A lot of people talk about it. I'm not sure how many people understand it. So we decided what better way to find out more about it than go to the gentleman who wrote the book. He literally wrote the book with Coach Smith. Dr. Jerry Bell is here with us. And you might be surprised to find out he's done quite a bit more than just write a book with Coach Smith. Dr. Bell, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me at a great occasion and a great topic.
Tell folks who may be sitting there in their cars going, now, I've seen this guy's name on the front of that book, but what else does he do? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So, long story short, I was born in a log cabin.
Nice. No.
So, I came to Carolina before your parents were born in 1963. And
Let me just say my parents are very excited that you said that. All right. Sorry. Sorry.
So I can tell them what life was like before they were born.
That's right.
So started working at Carolina as a professor and had grown up. My parents were born and raised in Kansas and farms met. And we always had an affinity with Dean's Smith because of we tell stories about where he was raised, as well as Bill Guthridge. So, but in any case, I started teaching here and became fascinated with leadership and psychology and psychiatry. So I built a life of teaching and research and focused. My total life has been devoted to studying how to be effective in leading people to build great organizations because I figured out over time, traveling and going around the world speaking, that the major problems in the world, such as poverty and destitution of a variety of human lives, that the only cure was to have leaders who built organizations worthy of human beings. Mm. So ultimately, poverty, I don't think, will be cured until we have leaders who build organizations, both businesses and hospitals and educational institutions and athletic teams that provide income and quality of learning and allow a worker to leave and go home at night and feel pride and have money to buy food and shelter. So plus I just grew up being fascinated with it. So I've spent my life trying to figure out how to build leaders. So I've done that at the Kenan Flagler Business School for many years and enjoyed enormous pleasure of being able to work with students and MBAs and executives and then technically formally retired and still is an adjunct professor in the Kenan Flagler Business School, but then built what's called Bell Leadership Institute as a way to be able to have a bigger platform to go around the world trying to teach leaders how to be effective and build organizations that are productive and contributory.
Okay. I have so many questions to ask in this interview. First of all, this is the first time that an interview guest has ever brought a headshot of me to the interview. So I'm a little psyched out about it.
And
right
he's
now.
16 years old.
Yeah, that's I look.
Why are there dart holes in there?
Yeah, that was 30 pounds ago. I look much better then.
He weighs 110 pounds.
I still weigh 110 pounds. Yeah. You talked about building a leader.
Mm-hmm.
How do you build a leader?
The fundamental qualities that build a leader are two major types of IQ. So, let me back up. There are three major sets of skills, but the two I'll focus on to being able to lead. Leaders lead according to who they are as a person. So your personality basically shapes how you lead. So the best way to build a leader is to build individuals who have what I call a clean ego. Basically, it's a healthy personality. So the cleaner your ego, the more you have a healthy personality, the better decisions you make and the better you relate to people, the more honest you are, the more you have all of the qualities that culminate in being an effective leader. So the way to you teach leadership, you teach things such as giving feedback and listening and making strategic decisions and how to build an organization and adapt to pressures for quality and performance. But ultimately, it really boils down to the personality qualities of the leader dictate the talents to lead, and the talents to lead are what dictate the profits or contributions of a business or a team. So the leadership qualities pretty much shape whether you have a healthy and effective family or a team or an organization. So the starting place is get at the root causes, mm-hmm. which is us.
We had this conversation off the air with a Carolina coach the other day, and I'd be interested to see what you think. In the limited time that a coach has with their team each day and each week, can you turn a me guy into a we guy?
great question. I'll think about it in this way. So I spent a lot of time actually with Coach Smith and some other wonderful coaches at Carolina and other places, but wrestling with how do you create and build teamwork. So particularly when you're recruiting all-star, all-Americans that everybody in the world names their streets after, and they come in as an 18-year-old hero, and stars twinkling in their eyes. So how do you get them to play as a team member? So, and the essence of, I think, of being a team player is learning how to be selfless and as opposed to selfish. And the way to do that is you can't just say, do that.
Right.
You have to, the way to do that, I think, is you have to get your players together and talk about that. And then you have them engage in a conversation. What do you win more by being selfless than you do by being selfish? Will you get a higher probability of getting a contract for the NBA by being selfless? And so you have to really think that through, because it's not intuitively yes answer,
right?
Because most people don't think so. But if you really get players to think about that and talk about that and then say, this is how we will win. And so you introduce by the we is basically the way to get to me. So you win better. So it, and you can't do that other than talking and trying to let them think about how they were shaped coming into a program such as Carolina or anywhere else.
Do you think that's harder for males? Because I do think sometimes that's not a natural thing for a young male to want to do. Yeah. To sit there nearby, let's all get together and talk about how we can do this together.
Yeah, I think you're no question that's the case. And I think particularly even in this day where we're working on equality of opportunity for genders, that men, boys are still trained to be, you've got to provide and you've got to be tough and you've got to be strong. And it's sort of opposed to being able to be more giving. And team means I dribble down the floor and I'm looking to make a play rather than to shoot.
Right.
And it's the same struggle. I know Anson Dorrance are great coaches and are marvelous field hockey and lacrosse coaches. I mean, we're just outstanding. But they also deal with these same questions, but in slightly different ways. And it's teaching players. Some players will come into Carolina and are overly focused on being accepted. Mm. So they're not as competitive. So they'll be a little more passive and won't quotes, take the shot or stand out. So, and some players, that's all they want to do. So it's a matter of teaching all of them. And your point, you have, Adam, you have a short amount of time. But it's, you have to invest time to build teams and teamwork. You can't just let it happen. You have to work at it.
Mm. So. You talked about decision making.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's one of the hardest things I would think as a head coach or a CEO or whatever it would be of, okay, you know what? It It's now. You're the one who has to make this decision. It has to be right now. What separates someone who makes the right decision and someone who doesn't make the right decision?
Yeah, well, if I think that there are two questions in your thought. One is, do you have the courage to make a decision?
Mm.
Do you have the willingness to stand up and make the call, even though you're going to get a lot of boos and it won't be perfect? So that takes an enormous amount of building yourself, and that's self-worth. And that's a great leader is a person who's willing to make a decision and go down the path alone with not a lot of people following him. So it's because you think it's right.
Right.
And now then the other question is, where does, if I understand it, is how do you decide, how do you build judgment? And the best way to build judgment is give students, kids, players, other people in an organization experience in making judgments. So you have to say, what do you think and how would you do it? And you let people make decisions that don't kill the organization, but may fail.
Right.
And so that motivates the person to think about what they did and look at their results. So judgment is learned, and it's learned by having many experiences where things didn't work out, and it's learned by getting feedback. And so one of the things about a healthy personality, excuse me here, is you really want to build your skill to take feedback, to seek out feedback, to welcome feedback, and you'll never do that until you decide that feedback is to your benefit, even when it's negative.
Sure.
As long as you dislike it, you'll suffer. I mean, we dislike, who likes it? But you really have to think through this. I'm going to be better for this.
Okay, can I ask you one?
Yeah,
so how do you balance having what you called, I think, the clean ego with also having a little bit of ego of saying, I know that I'm willing to do this. I know that this is the right thing to do. Does that question make sense?
Yeah.
How do you balance those two things?
Well, if let me try it this way. I think the more healthy your personality, the more likely you're willing to make judgment calls and get a lot of boos because you have thought through, you've done your homework, you think it's right, and the key is you're able to fail and get up again. So the fear of failing prevents people from making decisions. Mm-hmm. So actually, in the way most people think about a big ego is the bigger your ego, the worse the leader you are. So a big ego will cause a person to make decisions to make them look good, even if it's a bad decision.
Right.
And they won't listen to feedback or inputs because they have a need to act like they're important. So it's a mistake in our society to think about a big ego. I've had fun, for example, when people say, oh, he or she's got a big ego. So I ask, well, would you like them to have a small ego? And people look at you and sort of, well, I've never thought about it. What's the opposite of a big ego? What's a small ego? Well, that's the wrong answer, wrong question. It's the question of having a clean ego, not a faulty one.
Right.
So
anyone who has become a head coach at the University of North Carolina has already experienced success, and they know what they're doing if they're a coach. How did you persuade these folks who already think they know what they're doing that this guy sitting right here could tell them something that would be helpful to their team and would make them a better coach?
Two thoughts occurred to me, and you checked me on this. One is Dean Smith as an example. One of the qualities I love about Dean and is that he was an extraordinary learner. So he asked thousands of questions. And so I got involved with him because I was on the faculty and I did my teaching and research. And then in my early years, I did mostly therapy. So my spare time, I was trained as and worked on doing that. So I had a good friend. We had dinner group and we were all going out to dinner and having fun. Psychiatrist in Chapel Hill named Earl Summer. And so we would talk a lot and he would he was a good golfing buddy of Dean's, and he would ask questions, and I'd give him a bunch of ideas. So I ended up sort of being indirectly connected with Dean, and then Earl became ill, and then he suggested that Dean talk with me. So anyhow, I talked with Dean. So, but I would meet with Dean, and he would read everything you could imagine, from anthropology to religion to philosophy to psychology, and then he would ask me questions. And he was exceptionally intelligent. Everybody said he was smart. But I worked with a lot of really, really smart people. So you would have to be in a wavelength with Dean of talking quickly. So I would talk until an idea, and then it was like a rapid fire exchange, which I just was thrilled. But I could bring him new information and research, and he would devour it and think about it. And then we would talk about, well, how in the world do you apply this? So with your broader question, how do you get a leader or a coach who's a phenomenal coach to talk with someone else who is not a coach about ideas? And it's all you have to do is start with, well, ask them a couple questions. Like, I'd ask you guys, what are two things each of you could do that would make your programs even better? So
get rid of Adam is what.
Yeah, that's right. Hold on. Let me take some notes over here.
One.
Yeah, one. No less Adam. Okay.
Number two, quickly. Yeah.
More salary for Jones.
Yeah, that's it. The show's on the tracks.
So, but getting, because every person makes mistakes 100 times a day, and every person is continuously learning. The better the leader, the more they're a learner. And the more, if you just get them thinking about things that they can possibly do better, even though they're famous and successful, then they immediately want to learn. The worst leaders are the ones who avoid learning the most. The best leaders learn the most, seek out learning and so forth. So that if we do the wonderful job, which we're able to do at Carolina as an example of recruiting great coaches, they already are most likely avid learners.
So. You talked about when you were talking with Coach Smith, you'd have these discussions, and then it would be, well, how can you apply this?
Right.
Because I do think there's the academic discussion of this, and right. then there's the application of it in business or teams or whatever. How do you take that step from the academic kind of intelligent discussion to the, okay, now this can be a benefit for my organization?
Right. Well, excellent question, because there's something I call the five skill lag theory. There's a difference in knowing concepts and ideas and then doing it. The skill to implement is different. The skill to do surgery. You can teach medicine, and you can teach about the parasympathetic nervous system, and then you go out and see a patient,
right?
And then you apply it. So most people don't see the difference between knowledge and skill. So there's a skill in translating knowledge into skills.
Yeah.
So then teaching that and talking about how to do that. And Dean was, he wanted and needed the application. So how would I do that? So we would talk about something like teamwork and the thought of eventually like pointing to the passer. So one of this generated from some research. So I'll try to do this real quickly.
No, time limit.
Yeah. Reading and studying things like you would do if you were studying leadership. So studying the leadership in World War II and a variety of things. But one of the studies I found was that, I've forgotten the exact number, but maybe 50, 60, 70% of the soldiers in World War II who were in battles with guns didn't fire their rifles. So a bunch of the psychology division of the military went, well, now, this is not good. They're trained, ready to do, and they're being shot at. They don't fire their guns at the enemy. Why is that? Well, they did find that those who did fire their rifles they shot back at the enemy was because one of their team members, their friends, or their unit had been hurt or was damaged or be threatened. So now take that and say, now how do we build that into basketball? So you have to make sure they care about each other enough to be willing to sacrifice by practicing harder, doing the drills, and eventually you point to the passer because they helped you. So the people play the hardest for a team. Mm. Dean used to say that he got the most nervous playing golf in a pro-am where he was on a team and he might screw it up more than playing for the NCAA finals.
When you, before you were close with Coach Smith, when you were just observing him and mm-hmm. watching Carolina play basketball, mm-hmm. what traits did you see that stuck out to you as someone who knows a lot about leadership that made you think this guy is something special?
Well, I could see what you guys have seen, and then I spent a lot of time working with it. When there was a crisis stress point, we were losing, tense last few seconds, how he behaved in the huddle. So I'm watching and noticed the difference in terms of the players actually listened, whereas that maybe one out of 50 teams where the players are actually hearing what the coach says. Mm. When the coach is hysterical, screaming, drawing on a board 70 miles an hour, I always think if that was a team we were playing, oh boy, we're going to win now because they're so screwed up. They don't know what they're doing. But Dean would bring calmness to the players and excitement. So he would turn the conversation from, you could watch the players tense, panicked, looking around the room, and then gradually start looking at him. So if you look at old films, they're all looking at him, leaning in and hearing. And so he gave them when your team's all lost their focus, the best thing, you should stop and say, here's what we do. You have to give them an answer. Do this. Now they change their, what I call beta state confusion, and they go into the zone. So I could see that early on. And then, of course, because of what I do, and then I'd see Dean periodically early on. And then, of course, talking with him, I could see all that.
So if I want to watch a coach like Dr. Jerry Bell and assess him in my professional opinion uh-huh. of what kind of leader he is, the best time to watch him is when things are not going great.
Your true personality, thus your true leadership pattern, comes up under, first of all, stress, when you're under pressure. Secondly, when you don't think anyone watches you. Mm. Third, when you don't think it counts. Like people will be in an airport or in a restaurant and they'll treat a wait person horribly because they don't think it matters. Fourth is when you drink too much. And then the fifth time when your true personality comes out, when you're deeply loved. So the only time your truest personality comes out when you feel, and most people, this is very rare because most people don't have the luxury of ever having true, deep love. And so when you're loved, then you lower your guard because you don't hide, because you can be vulnerable. So the way to learn to build a leader and to build yourself, and the most important thing you could ever do is build yourself first, is be willing to find out how you behave when you're not on stage and the truth within you. So this is one reason why one of my goals is to start to renew our devotion at Carolina to the Carolina way. And I think we lost it. I think Dean helped to found it. And that stands for all of the things that I think Dean does, of doing things right, of winning the right way, of living with honesty and integrity, and then mastery, excellence. And we got nailed because of the problems, the academic screw-ups the university have, and then I got tons of letters from people at other universities laughing at us. The Carolina way worked great. Well, that's we fell to the loss of the Carolina way because of, I think, a little bit of guilt and shame. And I think that's silly. That was not the Carolina way. That was just exactly the opposite. So I think it would be, we have something really unique at Caroline. I think it would be wonderful for us to now take pride and launch it. So when a student enters Carolina, they begin living their life with the Carolina way, something to stand for and be proud of. So, go ahead.
No. I feel like for a second there, I felt like I was having like a little therapy session. So I really appreciate this.
I'm sure that you probably need a lot.
No, there is no doubt I do. I promise you that.
I'm going to go back and listen to this and write down what he just said.
Absolutely.
That was good.
Well, I feel like one thing I personally do negatively is deal with stress. Like, I feel like it definitely changes my performance when you're stressed. So I'm asking you, what's the best way to manage that? How do you not let that change your performance, your attitude, your ability?
Yeah, well, the things that you already know, but the first thing to do is you always, always say your job is to lead calmness. Mm. So when things are pressured and stressed, you go to calm. You go to calm, and if that helps you, you do it by taking, it's something called the relaxation response to reduce the production of a variety of cortisols and adrenaline in your physiology. But it's basically take three deep breaths and take a deep breath, hold it in, take another one, holding it in, and you take one more, but that relaxes your body. But the secret is immediately go to a solution. Mm. And your job as an announcer, as a leader, both of you guys, is to spread calmness and then to go to what can be done and how would we do it. So
when you started doing this, I'm guessing there weren't a lot of people doing what you were doing because this is kind of an intangible thing.
Yeah.
How did you persuade people that this is a real thing that matters and get people to listen to that in such a way that was so successful?
Great insight question. When I started, which was long ago, my wife grew up in Chapel Hill. Mm. By the way, her dad helped found the dental school here, of all things. So 1963, leadership was not taught. People believed you couldn't learn to be, you were born or bred in that, or born and that was it. You either had it. So we taught management, which was organizing and planning and things like that. So I was a very unusual person. And I think the reason I got into it is my father, mother, my dad's after World War II started a business. And I would go work in summers after school, starting at 6 or 7 years old. So I saw leadership and I'd go home at night. This is before TV and phones. And I would tell him what I saw and he would basically had tutorials in leadership. And so I became fascinated with watching and learning, and then started studying psychology, which was barely taught. And then I ended up going to graduate school at Yale and studying. They had a special program in basically medicine and psychology, so it's an unusual thing, and economics and business. So I studied all that stuff. And then the short version is I was a very unusual person, and I got a job at Harvard Business School. So they offered because they wanted some person who would study. It started out, they were interested in more consumer behavior, the psychology of why people buy stuff. Hmm. And so I knew a lot about that, but I would apply it to leadership. And so it was a gradual evolution where it's become more visible and more apparent, and it's become more normal. So your grandparents would not have
right
thought about it.
Why do people buy stuff?
Well, the depends on what it is, but people buy stuff, one for a functional reason, a dishwasher. But the important part is you buy things to fill your needs, that you believe this will help me achieve my needs. And so whether I need to be popular or I want to look good or...
Okay, keep talking. I like both those things.
I want prestige or I want to be included. So people buy things they believe will give them personality satisfaction more than functional.
If you don't have a clean ego, can you get one?
Sure.
Absolutely. How?
Well, you start with working on discovering the two IQs I started to talk about. Yourself, your self IQ is how well you know yourself. So the most significant thing I think a person can do in their life, the biggest decision you'll ever make, is what you do about yourself. And that's to spend time studying yourself. And how did you get to be like you are? How were you raised? What are your biggest psychological needs? I want this. Your goals. And what are your biggest psychological fears? This is, oh, I don't want this. I don't like that. And then what are your beliefs? So your behavior patterns are a result of your needs and your trying to avoid your fears and carrying out your beliefs. So the smartest thing you can do to build a clean ego is study yourself. And do research on yourself and listen to things. And I'll give you a practical exercise. This is practical learning. And that you guys would have fun this year. This is your assignment for the 2022.
I'm ready.
So to write down, start out with 10, looking for 10 things that you remember growing up, 10 experiences. And then try to build it to 15. And the reason that I say you can remember, because those things started to mold you and shape you. Because, you know, things that happened when you were little that you, gosh, you remember that and you thought a little bit about it and maybe didn't really understand it. But then a little later you thought back about it, tell stories about it. Start building a list and then elaborate them. Start describing them. Get up to 15 or so. And then the next step, as you develop a description, the next step is what did you learn from those things? So, and how did that affect you? And then how were you shaped? So the way you know yourself, self-IQ, is you know your personality habits. You know how you got them. You know the impact you have on others. And you know your strengths and weaknesses. So all you'd have to do is pick out three weaknesses you have, things you'd like to get better, and set this year to start working away at improving them, and set three strengths you want to build and start doing that. So self-IQ, and then the other one is people IQ, is understanding people.
I feel like whoever talks to me in like the next hour or two is going to get the absolute best Adam there's ever been.
Yeah, there's
now, if you talk to me tomorrow, I'm sorry. I don't know how good that's going to be. But in the next hour or two, you're never going to see anything like this before.
I've never understood myself better than I do right now.
I know. That's what I'm saying. This next pod's going to be incredible. If somebody asked me what the Carolina way is, I would probably take the very short answer and say, play hard, play smart, play together. But we've got the guy who wrote the book sitting right here. So if somebody asked you what the Carolina way is, what would you say?
Well, first of all, I think your goal is to behave in a way to cause people to play as hard as they can, to play as smart as they can, and play together. You cause that. The coaches cause that, and does the player. The way to do that is, I think the Carolina way stands for six things. It's first of all, that I'll do number one, is you live your life with deepest integrity a human being can have. Bone dry honesty. And even it's not, you do things that are right even though no one knows it. So, and that's one of Dean's most outstanding qualities. And so number one is you live honestly with courage and integrity and always do the right thing. And then be extraordinarily competitive to do your best, not to beat people. It's to do your best to excel. And so that's number one. Number two is you devote yourself to, but I'll do team building or people building. You build your efforts to help people grow and succeed and care about people. You love human beings, and you do the best to help them do their best. And I can give you 100 examples with Dean and others. The third thing you do is that you make a commitment to yourself. What we, as a student coming into Carolina, their obligation is to do everything they can to use their talents, to learn the most, to become the best, to achieve the most. So it's, don't be passive. You go for it. So you that's an honor code we have at the Carolina Way. The fourth thing is that you make a commitment yourself to take control of your life. Make sure you focus on getting things done, being organized, follow through. Learn to delay gratification. If you committed to do something, you do it and get it done. So it's taking ownership for yourself. The fifth thing is to learn how to fail really well to succeed. And to the key is getting up again. And then the key is to learn from your failure, figure out how to patch it up, and then forgive yourself 100%, and then focus on the next play, achieve forward. So it's learning to live a life being peaceful because you're not worried about failing. To excel, put yourself in positions where you do fail. It's not avoiding failure. It's recovering from failure. It's learning. Failure is learning. And then the final thing is to be extraordinarily creative and innovative and learn to have fun and enjoy your life. So six elements of the Carolina Way.